Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organizational studies, brought to you with the support of the University of Sussex Business School. This is episode 46, which features a live recording from a professional development workshop on classics in organizational and management theory, held at the 78th annual meeting of the Academy of Management in Chicago. To learn more about the event, please visit our new website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This workshop was intended to raise interest towards classic authors and ideas in the field of organization and management theory. So, it echoes the goal of our podcast to disseminate ideas about organizational theory with a special focus on the classics. The rationale for the workshop is that our field, although relatively young, seems sometimes more attentive to disruptions than continuities, novelty instead of tradition. So we hope too that the workshop would help making us more aware regarding connections between earlier and current scholarship, and enable us to explore how ideas, concepts, approaches from the classics, broadly understood, might better equip us to understand current affairs. The workshop included four senior scholars, and each one of them presented about the work of an author they believe is important for organization and management theory. The audience was made up of participants from the Academy of Management annual meeting. We were oversubscribed this year, so apologies for those who could not be included in the event. The good news is that you can now listen to the presentations from the workshop. Also, we are already planning the next year's workshop for the Academy of Management 2019, in which we hope to accommodate a larger crowd, and that workshop will probably focus on contingent theory, so stay tuned for news about that. The second speaker was Silva Dourado, who is an associate professor of management at the University of Rhode Island. Silva talked about Albert Hirschman, an important economist and prolific author who lived between 1915 and 2012.
Hi everybody. So I'm going to be talking about Albert Hirschman, and Albert Hirschman is probably not in the Oxford book. Albert Hirschman tends to be a political economist and was better known as an economist, and I don't think he has got enough attention in the management literature, which is probably the reason that when Pedro asked me what author would you want to talk about, I said Albert Hirschman. One of the reasons I also am very interested in Albert Hirschman. My dissertation was in Bolivia, and in management, the management literature, the classics that I was studying in my PhD program, was not particularly helpful to think about Bolivia. It was a big exercise to create a bridge, and I'm always amazed a little bit on the boundaries that we create for ourselves, having scholars in other fields, such as Albert Hirschman, whose original work came from Colombia and came from developing countries, and that we could actually be building on, and the bridge will be much easier because he was educated on the social theories. You know, he was educated in Marx, he was educated in Weber, so he actually did some of that legwork for us. So particularly now that I think in organization studies and in management, we are exploring, many more of us are actually exploring questions in developing countries, that is really time to capture the richness of the ideas that Hirschman brought. So, these are some of his best-known works. It seems like everybody knows Exit, Voice, and Loyalty. If you haven't read it and you're about to cite it, it's a tiny little book. It began as a little paper that then he expanded. And he's such a beautiful writer that it is a book that you can read on a Saturday, okay? So that's an amazing book. The Passion and the Interest is a historical essay going from Aristotle's to, you know, modern thinkers, and so it's a beautiful trip, again, an amazing writer giving you a mix of history with ideas, so a wonderful read that I actually read well before I was in academia on a summer, and it's a really nice read. His earlier trilogy is a little more of work, because they come from economics, but it's really the work that is more grounded and more helpful for people interested in doing research in developing countries. And then he has a really long bibliography, a plurality of essays. He's very well known for this, A Bias for Hope, and then this propensity of self-subversion, which he was actually to rethink and retool everything that he had offered to the literature, because he was always a self-critic. This is my version of it. And I think I wanted to do this, or I did this tiny little graph, which probably doesn't do as much justice to this thinking as it should, because in a way, we could put management there, okay? So you have a strategy on the left with economics, you have organization studies, because I put political science there, it's more loyal to Fishman, but sociology will fit very well there, and social psychology, which is organizational behavior. So he is actually a scholar who was building and on a regular basis connecting these three fields, which are very familiar to us. And his focus was on change, organizational change, systems change, society change. That was all his quest. And I think I can say that with a lot of confidence. Economics was his playground. He was interested fundamentally in economic development and inequality. So that's sort of the what. The who, he was fundamentally thinking about bureaucrats. And I particularly has always found it inspirational, because if you do work on development, you don't want to go around and say to people, well, you know, you want microfinance, why don't you get Mohamed Yunus? Okay? And if we just had enough Mohamed Yunus to go around, the world will be a better place. We have these histories full of heroes, and it's just not very useful to think about bringing change to the world in terms of heroes. Because heroes are great, Mohamed Yunus is great, but you cannot replicate Mohamed Yunus. So Hirschman was always far more interested in how that bureaucrat in this province in Colombia can actually engage and bring change. He was much more interested in everyday people and thinking about that specific question. So his who is the everyday person. That's the people that he's thinking. He drew particularly for Franz Festinger in Stanford social psychology. And he was very interested in how can people get uncomfortable enough to actually bring change? And that's where he drew from social psychology. And he had a love affair with France, even though he's from German origin and he actually studied in Italy. So his intellectual life, academic life was in France, and he would always talk about his ideas as petite ideas. And we also have to put him in the context that he was coming behind Marx, and these were big ideas. And he was far more interested in the petite idea. How can I have a petite idea that can be useful for the bureaucrat in this municipality doing this specific work? This is how he saw himself in relation to Marxism. So the historical period that he's writing, this is in the late 50s, the 1960s, we are having a lot of questioning, the movements of the late 1960s, okay? And so he's receiving a lot of backlash from the new voices in academia, which are actually Marxist voices. And this is his response to them. What am I? What is my academia? My academia is in increasing the number of options. There has to be a space between neoliberal economics and Marxist economics, and this is the space where I want to operate. I don't want to have a complete, free liberal economics, and I don't want to have a revolutionary changing of capitalism. There has to be intermediate solutions. So I'm just going to have my petite ideas, and I'm going to work within this space. So the first three books, which he wrote, they're very connected. He didn't think about it as a trilogy initially, but every time he would write a book, he would have these ideas that needed further exploring, and so it finished being a trilogy, and the three of them are very connected. So I'm going to spend some time here because this tends to be the area that is least familiar to people. Okay, so the way he operates and the way he writes his books, is this a bit of a departure, no? A thesis that he's holding on his head. And the thesis in this trilogy was this fracassomania. So fracassomania is you think that you're gonna fail. Okay? So he has this idea of unbalanced development. We're coming from the Marshall Plan in Europe. Okay? It was like a big investment in Europe and everything is gonna move from there. So can we apply the Marshall Plan to developing countries? Well, it's not that clear what's going on, what are the faults, okay? So he says, our investigation, meaning his ideas, holds that if only we can remove or neutralize our difficulty, then all other bottlenecks, serious as they may be, will go away. He's not talking about the needed factors. He's not talking about capital or labor.
Our diagnosis is simply that countries fail to take advantage of their development potential because for regions largely related to the image of change. So we're going back to social psychology. It has to do with these individuals and the specific way that they see what they can change and where to go when they're changing. So how can we change this? What is going to be the petit idée? And he has several. Okay, I'm just introducing you to a couple of them. So one of them is increase awareness. And he gets this idea from his observations. He's absolutely grounded. All what he does, even though he's an economist, is case studies. Okay? And he's traveled widely in developing countries, and he wonders, how is it that we can trust a developing country airline, that they're very safe, they're as safe as any other airline, but we cannot trust the roads. The roads will have this big hole. Both of them are modes of transportation. Both of them involve engineers. Both of them are for developing countries. How is it that developing countries' planes don't fall, but people die all the time in developing countries' roads? What is the difference between roads and planes? And exploring that idea, he comes with this idea of a narrow latitude for error. What happens when a plane falls? When a plane falls, it's big news. A lot of people die at the same time. It's a huge tragedy. What happens when there's traffic accidents? People die in a much more slower pace, and you don't get it on the news. So is there any way that we can build on this for my bureaucrat in this province in Colombia to bring about change? Well, we can do this if we actually work on mechanisms to have increased awareness. So he provides the answer. It's like, what about, instead of paving roads with like rocks and gravel, which might be more long-lasting, I should pave them with bituminous pavement, because then it's going to become more visible, okay? So it's not a big idea. This is not the revolution. We're not fencing with capitalism. But maybe if we think through what is the difference between planes and roads, we can come up with an answer that creates the motivation for actors to act and become engaged. Another petit idée is a hiding hand. So, we all have, hide the invisible hand of the market and, the visible hand of the businesses. These are not those hands, okay? He's going back to social psychology. And the hiding hand is that once you become engaged into doing something, and you actually have to keep doing, you finish being engaged into action in a way that you are much more in a problem-solving mechanism. This is very Kawai. Okay, if you read the Munchausen's disaster, you cannot escape the fire, so you need to do something. So why don't we create a burn area and we stay there, okay? So we humans have this double set of circumstances. On the one hand, we are creative. On the other hand, sometimes we get ourselves into challenges that are beyond what we can do. And once you get yourself into that position, you may actually be able, if you cannot escape the situation, to engage in creative ideas. If I can give you an example, maybe some of you know the Irvine Hospital for Cataract Surgery. I don't want to spend a lot of time giving it to you, but that's an example of that. The people that started cataract surgery, they finished creating a factory of lenses, okay? Which they promised. They were not set up to do it at the very beginning. It only came at the very end. If you would have told the people that built this factory of ocular lenses, that they were going to build a factory of ocular lenses, when they started this project, they would have said, not in a million years. Not in a million years. They finished doing something that was very revolutionary, but it was because they started on a specific path, and the path drove them to that specific destination. So one of the challenges that we have in management is this lack of temporality of our status. We tend to think on a one-time plane, in which, I cannot build a factory of ocular lenses because I don't have enough resources in this country. So we're just thinking in one time. What Hirschman is telling you is there is temporality and that the past is pushing you towards the future. And there is not only that specific context, but what you did on the past moves you to what you're going to do. So temporality is much better captured in this idea of the hiding hand. Okay, exit goals and loyalty. I love this sentence. This is how he starts the book, okay? This is the departure, okay? So he wonders, rhetorically and ironically, how is it How is it that baboon bands have no problem, killing their leaders pretty much? So when they have poor leaders, they just, they have a very good system of getting better leaders. Why? Because if not, they will die. And we humans have a much higher tolerance for poor leadership. Much higher tolerance. So why we have this much higher tolerance for poor leadership? And he says, well, it's the nature of society. Society's ability to take considerable deterioration on a stride. We actually have enough resources that allows us to live for a very long time with bad leadership, on a way not realizing that we are getting ourselves into big trouble. So that's the problem. That's the departure. That's where he's coming from. Okay, that's exit voice and loyalty. So the problem here is motivation. Here the actors are able to do this, but they don't have the motivation. Okay, it's not the day. Okay, we're not going to run out of food. Climate change is going to happen, but it's not going to be tomorrow while we're doing our presentation. So the rest of the book, a lot of it is really an exploration. And I think people have cited it in management because it has helped us understand our organizations. Okay, but it's really an exploration, and I'm not going to spend much time there. He's trying to go back to his petit idée. And actually, the book, he got it out very quickly. He was interested in doing all the projects. And if you read it, for me, that's the most interesting part, but it's the less developed. Okay? So what he's trying to figure out is, like, how can we escape this situation? And he goes back to Festinger, and he goes back to the idea of dissonance, and he talks about social dissonance. One example of social dissonance, a wonderful book by a political economist called Peter Evans, Embedded Autonomy, from 1994, gives a great example of the relevance of thinking about this in terms of social dissonance. So social dissonance means that you become a member of a club, and which is very hard for you to become a member, like classical from France, okay? You have a really high barrier of entry. Once you have such a high barrier of entry, what happens? You develop a strong loyalty to that specific group. Okay? And if you become, if you have that connection to a specific group, now even you may completely disagree with who they are, but you're very attached to them. Okay? So Peter Evans has this idea of embedded autonomy, which can really bring in, granovetter idea of embeddedness, with an idea of meritocracy together. So he differentiates between states thinking on this dissonant loyalty. So what is the difference between Southeast Asian countries and Congo in Africa in terms of the effectiveness of bureaucrats in these countries to bring about economic development? And the difference has to do with the connections these people have. So if in Southeast Asia, he uses the example of Japan, people has very strong personal connections because they have gone to school with these people between businesses and the state. Okay? And there's no separation. Me coming from Spain, one of the reasons Spain came out in this economic development is because we had these people that had, they were a meritocratic system, but they would bring them in the state. And you have that high entrance system, it was very hard to become a bureaucrat, the same thing that it was in Japan, but you had this connection with the people. And by having this connection with the people, so people will have, primary education and will be able to get these exams, you create this dual connection. You wouldn't have that in Zaire. In Zaire, what you had is the ruling class replicating themselves and a big separation with the rest of the society. So when you get this big separation is when you get, these kind of like predatory relations in which one part abuses the other part. And which is a big concern for all of us because inequality is growing and we are getting more and more this like circular replications in which the elites are replicating themselves and you have this separation with the rest of the people. So these are the dissonant connections that bridge across different groups of people and thereby you can have the motivation to engage. The passion and the interest, very quickly, so it's an exploration of these three vices and these three ideas. That's a quote from Giambattista Vico. And so the three vices that define humanity are ferocity, avarice, and ambition. And the reason we have capitalism Okay, it's because you know, we are much happier with avarice as a sin, and we can manage avarice as a sin. And so, is the last sentence. So the pursuit of private utility are transformed into a civil order that permits to live in human society. So the reason that we have capitalism is because the pursuit of the private interest is the best. So Hirschman's Petite Idée is much more of a Gideon Paul Albert, which is talking about it, more of a structuration idea, is that you have this civil order emerges from the pursuit of private utility because it produces more predictability. The fundamental search is for ontological security. And because people like ontological security, we are willing to sacrifice into a number of areas, and we're willing to give the search for private utility the ruling of the world. Just going back, these are some of the petite idées. So you have the idea of the increased awareness, a very situated concept. Okay, can we design things in such a way that we actually get people more engaged? We have this idea of the hiding hand, which is about temporality. You know, coming from the past and going into the future, we're going to be able to engage and bring about change. What is the motivation for a change? People living can be a motivation for a change. Social movements can create a motivation for a change, which is voice. This idea of social dissonance, in which you have connections with unexpected people, and that can create a motivation for change. And then this idea of that one of the driving forces, more than greed being the driving force that will give us a civic society, is actually the search for predictability and security that is the driving force. You want to read first, Worldly Philosopher is a blast, it's a great book. There is a collection of essays, and the essays are short and great, from 2015, and there's a great book full of case studies from 1994, which is a great introduction.